Send Me to Sleep is a production of Slumber Studios and is made possible thanks to the generous support of our sponsors and premium members. If you'd like to listen ad-free and have access to special bonus episodes, you can try out Premium Free for 7 days by following the link in the episode notes. Now, we'll be right back after a quick word from our sponsors.
This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance. And you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hills, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to Send Me to Sleep. The place to find a good night's rest. My name's Andrew. Thanks for joining me, and for taking this time for yourself to ensure you get a peaceful night's sleep. Tonight, I'll be reading North and South by Elizabeth Gaskell, Chapter 36. In this chapter, Margaret and Mr. Hale pay a visit to Nicholas Higgins. This episode contains themes of death that some listeners may find unsettling. If you haven't already, find a nice place to get cozy. Take a deep, relaxing breath. And settle your body in whatever way feels most comfortable. Now all you'll need to do is follow the sound of my voice. So let your eyes fall heavy and your breath soften as we settle in for a peaceful night's sleep. Chapter 36. Union Not Always Strength. The steps of the bearers, heavy and slow. The sobs of the mourners, deep and low. Shelley. At the time arranged the previous day, they set out on their walk to see Nicholas Higgins and his daughter. They both were reminded of their recent loss by a strange kind of shyness in their new habiliments, and in the fact that it was the first time, for many weeks, that they had deliberately gone out together. They drew very close to each other in unspoken sympathy. Nicholas was sitting by the fireside in his accustomed corner, but he had not his accustomed pipe. He was leaning his head upon his hand, his arm resting on his knee. He did not get up when he saw them, though Margaret could read the welcome in his eye. "Sit ye down, sit ye down. Fire's welly out," said he, giving it a vigorous poke as if to turn attention away from himself. He was rather disorderly, to be sure, with a black, unshaven beard of several days' growth, making his pale face look yet paler, and a jacket which would have been all the better for patching. "We thought we should have a good chance of finding you, just after dinner time," said Margaret. "We have had our sorrows too, since we saw you," said Mr. Hale. "Aye, aye. Sorrows is more plentiful than dinners just now, I reckon. My dinner hour stretches all over the day. You're pretty sure of finding me." "Are you out of work?" asked Margaret. "Aye," he replied shortly. Then, after a moment's silence, he added, looking up for the first time, "I'm not wanting brass. Dunno you think it. Bess, poor lass, had a little stock under her pillow, ready to slip into my hand last moment, and Mary is fustian cutting. But I'm out of work of the same." "We owe Mary some money," said Mr. Hale, before Margaret's sharp pressure on his arm could arrest the words. "If who takes it, I'll turn her out of doors. I'll bide inside these four walls, and she'll bide out. That's that." "But we owe her many thanks for her kind service," began Mr. Hale again. "I ne'er thanking your daughter for her deed of love to my poor wench. I ne'er could find the words. I shall have to begin to try now, if you start making ado about what little Mary could serve you." "Is it because of the strike you're out of work?" asked Margaret gently. "Strike's ended. It's over for this time. I'm out of work because I ne'er asked for it. And I ne'er asked for it because good words is scarce, and bad words is plentiful." He was in a mood to take a surly pleasure in giving answers that were like riddles. But Margaret saw that he would like to be asked for the explanation. "And good words are?" "Asking for work. I reckon them's almost the best words that men can say. Gimme work means, and I'll do it like a man. Them's good words. And bad words are refusing your work when you ask for it." "Aye. Bad words is saying, 'Aha, my fine chap, you've been true to your order, and I'll be true to mine. You did the best you could for them as wanted help. That's your way of being true to your kind, and I'll be true to mine. You've been a poor fool, as known no better nor be a true faithful fool. So good'n be gone to you. There's no work for you here. Them's bad words. I'm not a fool, and if I was, folk ought to have taught me how to be wise after their fashion. I could mayhappen have learnt if anyone had tried to teach me." "Could it not be worthwhile," said Mr. Hale, "to ask your old master if he would take you back again? It might be a poor chance, but it would be a chance." He looked up again, with a sharp glance at the questioner, and then tittered a low and bitter laughter. "Master, if it's no offence, I'll ask you a question or two in turn." "You're quite welcome," said Mr. Hale. "I reckon you're some way off earning your bread. Folk seldom live St. Milton just for pleasure, if they can live anywhere else." "You're quite right. I have some independent property, but my intention in settling in Milton was to become a private tutor. To teach folk? Well, I reckon they pay you for teaching them, do they not?" "Yes," replied Mr. Hale, smiling. "I teach in order to get paid." "And them that pays you, don't they tell you what'n to do, or what not to do with the money they gives you, in just payment for your pains, in fair exchange, like?" "No, to be sure not. They dunna say, you may have a brother, or a friend as dear as a brother, who wants this here brass for a purpose both you and he think right. But you mun't promise not to give it to him. You may see a good use, as you think, to put your money to, but we don't think it's good. So if you spend it on him, we'll leave off dealing with you. They dunna say that, dun they?" "No, to be sure not." "Would you stand if they did?" "It would be some very hard pressure that would make me even think of submitting to such dictation." "There's not the pressure on all the broad earth that would make me," said Nicholas Higgins. "Now you've got it. You've hit the bull's eye. Hampers. That's where I worked. Makes their men pledge themselves they'll not give a penny to union, or keep turnouts from clemming. They may pledge and make pledge," continued he, scornfully. "They do not make liars and hypocrites. And that's a less sin, to my mind, to make men's hearts so hard that they'll not do a kindness to them as need it, or help on the right and just cause, though it goes against the strong hand. But I'll never forswear myself for the work the king could give me. I'm a member at the union, and I think it's the only thing to do the workmen any good. And I've been a turnout, and known what it was to clem. So if I get a shilling, sixpence shall go to them if they ax me for it. Consequences, I do not see where I'm to get a shilling." "Is that rule about not contributing to the union in force at all in the mills?" asked Margaret. "I cannot say. It's a new regulation at ours, and I reckon they'll find they cannot stick to it. But it's in force now. By and by, they'll find out. Tyrants make lies." There was a little pause. Margaret was hesitating whether she should say what was in her mind. She was unwilling to irritate one who was always gloomy and despondent enough. At last, out it came, but in her soft tones and with her reluctant manner, showing that she was unwilling to say anything unpleasant. It did not seem to annoy Higgins, only to perplex him.
Do you remember poor Boucher saying that the Union was a tyrant? I think he said it was the worst tyrant of all. And I remember, at the time, I agreed with him. It was a long while before he spoke. He was resting his head on his two hands and looking down into the fire, so she could not read the expression on his face. "I'll not deny but what a union finds it necessary to force a man into his own good. I'll speak truth. A man leads a dree life who's not into union. But once into union, his interests are taken care on better nor he could do in it for himself, or by himself for that matter. It's the only way working men can get their rights, by all joining together. More the members, more chance for each one separate man having justice done him. Government takes care of fools and madmen, and if any man is inclined to do himself or his neighbour a hurt, it puts a bit of a check on him, whether he likes it or no. That's all we do in union. We can't clap folk into prison, but we can make a man's life so heavy to be born that he'll oblige to come in and be wise and helpful in spite of himself. Boucher were a fool all along, and ne'er a worse fool than at the last. "He did you harm?" asked Margaret. "Aye, that he did. We had public opinion on our side, till he and his sort began rioting and breaking laws. It were all over with the strike then." "Then would it not have been far better to have left him alone and not forced him to join the union? He did you no good, and you drove him mad?" "Margaret," said her father, in a low and warning tone, for he saw the cloud gathering on Higgins' face. "I like her," said Higgins suddenly, "who speaks plain out what in her mind. Who doesn't comprehend union for all that? It's a great power. It's our only power. I read a bit of poetry about a plough going o'er a daisy as made tears come into my eyes, afore I'd had other cause for crying. But the chap near stopped driving the plough. I's his warrant, for all he was pitiful about the daisy. He too much mother wit for that. The union's the plough, making ready the land for harvest time. Such as Boucher, 'twould be setting him up too much to liken him to a daisy. He's like a weed lounging over the ground. One just made up their mind to be put out of the way. I'm sore vexed with him just now. So may happen I dunna speak him fair. I could go over him with a plough myself. We'll have the pleasure in life." "Why, what has he been doing? Anything fresh?" "Aye, to be sure. He's ne'er out of mischief, that man. First off, he must go raging like a mad fool and kick up yon riot. Then he got to go into hiding, where he'd have been yet, if Thornton had followed him out as I'd hoped he would have done. But Thornton, having got his own purpose, didn't care to go with the prosecution for the riot. so Bosha slunk back again to his house. He never showed himself abroad for a day or two. He had that grace. And then, where think ye that he went? Why, to Amper's. Damn him. He went with his mealy-mouthed face that turns me sick to look at, asking for work, though he knowed well enough the new rule of pledging themselves to give naught to union, naught to help the starving turnout. Why, he'd have clemmed to death if t' union hadn't helped him in his pinch. There he went, oozing to promise aught and pledge himself to aught, to tell all he know on our proceedings. A good for nothing Judas. But I'll say this for Amper, and thank him for it at my dying day. He drove Bosha away, and would ne listen to him. Ne'er a word, though folk standing by says that the traitor cried like a baby. Oh, how shocking, how pitiful, exclaimed Margaret. Higgins, I don't know you today. Don't you see how you've made Bosha what he is, by driving him into the union against his will, without his heart going with it? You have made him what he is. Made him what he is. What was he? Gathering along the narrow street, came a hollow, measured sound, now forcing itself of their attention. Many voices were hushed and low. Many steps were heard, not moving onward, at least not with any rapidity or steadiness of motion, but as if circling round one spot. Yes, there was one distinct, slow tramp of feet, which made itself a clear path through the air, and reached to their ears. The measured, laboured walk of men carrying a heavy burden. They were all drawn towards the house door by some irresistible impulse, impelled thither, not by a poor curiosity, but as if by some solemn blast. 6 men walked in the middle of the road, 3 of them being policemen. They carried a door, taken off its hinges, upon their shoulders, on which lay some dead human creature, and from each side of the door there were constant droppings. All the street turned out to see, and, seeing, to accompany the procession, each one questioning the bearers, who answered almost reluctantly at last, so often had they told the tale. We found him in t' brook in the field beyond there. T' brook? Why, there's not water enough to drown him. He was a determined chap. He lay with his face downward. He was sick enough of living. Choose what cause he had for it. Higgins crept up to Margaret's side and said in a weak, piping kind of voice, "It's not John Bosha. He had ne spunk enough. Sure, it's not John Bosha. Why, they are a-looking this way. Listen, I've a singing in my head, and I cannot hear." They put the door down carefully upon the stones, and all might see the poor, drowned wretch. His glassy eyes, one half open, staring right upwards to the sky. Owing to the position in which he had been found lying, his face was swollen and discoloured. Besides, his skin was stained by the water in the brook, which had been used for dyeing purposes. The fore part of his head was bald, but the hair grew thin and long behind, and every separate lock was a conduit for water. Through all these disfigurements, Margaret recognized John Bowsher. It seemed to her so sacrilegious to be peering into that poor, distorted, agonized face, that, by a flash of instinct, she went forward and softly covered the dead man's countenance with her handkerchief. The eyes that saw her do this followed her as she turned away from her pious office, and were thus led to the place where Nicholas Higgins stood, like one rooted to the spot. The men spoke together, and then one of them came up to Higgins, who would have fain shrunk back into the house. "Higgins, thou known him, thou mun go tell the wife. Do it gently, man, but do it quick, for we cannot leave him here long." "I canna go," said Higgins. "Do not ask me. I canna face her." "Thou knows her best," said the man. "We'n done a deal in bringing him here. Thou take thy share." "I canna do it," said Higgins. "I'm welly felled with seeing him. We wasn't friends, and now he's dead." "Well, if thou were not, thou were not. Someone must, though. It's a dree task, but it's a chance. Every minute, as she doesn't hear on it in some rougher way, nor a person going to make her last on by degrees, as it were." "Papa, do you go," said Margaret in a low voice. "If I could, if I had time to think of what I had better say. But all at once..." Margaret saw that her father was indeed unable. He was trembling from head to foot. "I will go," she said. "Bless you, miss. It will be a kind act, for she's been but a sickly sort of body, I hear, and a few hereabouts know much on her." Margaret knocked at the closed door, but there was such a noise, as if of many little ill-ordered children, that she could hear no reply. Indeed, she doubted if she was heard, and as every moment of delay made her recoil from her task more and more, she opened the door and went in, shutting it after her, and even, unseen by the woman, fastening the bolt. Mrs. Bowsher was sitting in a rocking chair on the other side of the ill-red-up fireplace. It looked as if the house had been untouched for days by any effort at cleanliness. Margaret said something. She hardly knew what. Her throat and mouth were so dry, and the children's noise completely prevented her from being heard. She tried again. "How are you, Mrs. Bowsher?" "But very poorly, I'm afraid." "I've had chance of being well," said she, querulously. I'm left alone to manage these childer, and not for to give them, for to keep them quiet. John should ne'er left me, and me so poorly. How long is it since he went away? 4 days since. No one would give him work here, and he'd gone on to tramp towards Greenfield. But he might have been back afore this, or sent me some word if he'd getting work. He might. Oh, don't blame him, said Margaret. He felt it deeply, I'm sure. Will too old bide in and let me hear the lady speak, addressing herself in no very gentle voice to a little urchin of about a year old. She apologetically continued to Margaret. He's always mithering me for Daddy and Butty. I had no butties to give him, and Daddy's away, and forgotten us, I think. He's his father's darling, he is, said she, with a sudden turn of mood, and, dragging the child up to her knee, she began kissing it fondly. Margaret laid her hand on the woman's arm to arrest her attention. Their eyes met. Poor little fellow, said Margaret slowly. He was his father's darling. He is his father's darling, said the woman, rising hastily and standing face to face with Margaret. Neither of them spoke for a moment or two. Then Mrs. Bosher began in a low, growling tone, gathering in wildness as she went on. He is his father's darling, I say. Poor folk can love their chiller as well as rich. Why dunno you speak? Why don't you stare at me with your great, pitiful eyes? Where's John? Weak as she was, she shook Margaret to force out an answer. Oh my God, she said, understanding the meaning of that tearful look. She sank back into the chair. Margaret took up the child and put him into her arms. He loved him, said she. Aye, said the woman, shaking her head. He loved us all. We had someone to love us once. It's a long time ago, but when he were in life and with us, he did love us, he did. He loved this babby Mappin the best on us, but he loved me, and I loved him, though I was calling him 5 minutes agone. Are you sure he's dead? Said she, trying to get up. If it's only that he's ill and like to die, they may bring him round yet. I'm but an ailing creature myself. I've been ailing this long time. But he is dead. He is drowned. Folk are brought round after they're dead drowned. What was I thinking of, to sit still when I should be stirring myself? Here withest thee, child, withest thee. Take this, take heart to play with, but do not cry while my heart's breaking. Oh, where is my strength gone to? Oh, John, husband, Margaret saved her from falling by catching her in her arms. She sat down in the rocking chair and held the woman upon her knees, her head lying on Margaret's shoulders. The other children, clustered together in affright, began to understand the mystery of the scene. But the idea came slowly, for their brains were dull and languid of perception. They set up such a cry of despair as they guessed the truth, that Margaret knew not how to bear it. Johnny's cry was loudest of them all, though he knew not why he cried. Poor little fellow. The mother quivered as she lay in Margaret's arms. Margaret heard a noise at the door. Open it quick, said she to the eldest child. It's bolted. Make no noise. Be very still. Oh, Papa, let them go upstairs very softly and carefully, and perhaps she will not hear them. She has fainted, that's all. It's all as well for her, poor creature, said a woman, following in the wake of the bearers of the dead. But you're not fit to hold her. Stay, I'll run fetch a pillow, and we'll let her down easy on the floor. This helpful neighbour was a great relief to Margaret. She was evidently a stranger to the house, a newcomer in the district, indeed. But she was so kind and thoughtful that Margaret felt she was no longer needed, and that it would be better, perhaps, to set an example of clearing the house, which was filled with idle, if sympathizing, gazes. She looked round to Nicholas Higgins. He was not there. So she spoke to the woman who had taken the lead in placing Mrs. Beauchamp on the floor. Can you give all these people a hint that they had better leave in quietness, so that when she comes round, she could only find one or two that she knows about her? Papa, will you speak to the men and get them to go away? She cannot breathe, poor thing, with this crowd about her. Margaret was kneeling down by Mrs. Beauchamp and bathing her face with vinegar. But in a few minutes, she was surprised at the gush of fresh air. She looked round and saw a smile pass between her father and the woman. What is it? Asked she. Only our good friend here, replied her father. It on a capital expedient for clearing the place. I bid 'em be gone, and each take a child with them, and to mind that they were orphans, and their mother a widow. It was who could do most, and the children are sure of a bellyful today, and of kindness too. Does who know how he died? No, said Margaret. I could not tell her all at once. Who mun be told because of the inquest? See, who's coming round? Shall you or I do it? Or mappin' your father would be best? No, you, said Margaret. They awaited her perfect recovery in silence. Then the neighbour woman sat down on the floor and took Mrs. Beauchamp's head and shoulders in her lap. Neighbour, said she, your man is dead. Guess you how he died. He were drowned, said Mrs. Bosher, feebly, beginning to cry for the first time at this rough probing of her sorrows. "He were found drowned. He were coming home very hopeless, aught on earth. He thought God couldna be harder than men. Mappen not so hard. Mappen as tender as a mother. Mappen tenderer. I'm not saying he did right, and I'm not saying he did wrong. All I say is, may neither me nor mine never have this sore heart, or we may do like things. He's left me alone with these children," moaned the widow, less distressed at the manner of the death than Margaret expected. But it was a piece with her helpless character to feel his loss as principally affecting herself and her children. "Not alone," said Mr. Hale solemnly. "Who is with you? Who will take up your cause?" The widow opened her eyes wide and looked at the new speaker, of whose presence she had not been aware till then. "Who has promised to be a father to the fatherless?" continued he. "But I've getten 6 children, sir, and the eldest not 8 years of age. I'm not meaning for to doubt his power, sir. Only, it needs a deal of trust." And she began to cry afresh. "Who'll be able better to talk tomorrow, sir?" said the neighbour. "Best comfort now would be to feel of a child at her heart. I'm sorry they took the baby." "I'll go for it," said Margaret. And in a few minutes, she returned carrying Johnny, his face all smeared with eating, and his hands loaded with treasures in the shape of shells and bits of crystal, and the head of a plaster figure. She placed him on his mother's arms. "There," said the woman. "Now you go. They'll cry together and comfort together, better nor anyone but a child can do. I'll stop with her as long as I'm needed, and if you come tomorrow, you can have a deal of wise talk with her that she's not up to today." As Margaret and her father went slowly up the street, she paused at Higgins's closed door. "Shall we go in?" asked her father. "I was thinking of him too." They knocked. There was no answer, so they tried the door. It was bolted, but they thought they heard him moving within. "Nicholas," said Margaret. There was no answer, and they might have gone away, believing the house to be empty, if there had not been some accidental fall, as if a book within. "Nicholas," said Margaret again, "it's only us. Won't you let us come in?" "No," said he. "I spoke as plain I could, about using words, when I bolted to the door. Let me be this day." Mr. Hale would have urged their desire, but Margaret placed her finger on her lips. "I don't wonder at it," said she. "I myself long to be alone. It seems the only thing to do one good after a day like this."